All right. We are in chapter 17. And God has changed Abraham's name and is about to change Sarah's name. Well, Sarai's name to Sarah. I mean, the addition of a hey is God's name. Yud is the Sarai, how Sarah usually ends, is the least significant of the Hebrew letters. When Yehoshua's called once Hoshea and then Yehoshua, so the Midrash is that the Yud migrated from Sarai's name to Yehoshua's name. But apart from that, not that I know of, I have no doubt that there are complicated numerological, Kabbalistic... you realize the reason, I think I've mentioned this before, but it is worth mentioning again. The reason that numerology is so prevalent in Jewish tradition is that Hebrew letters were numbers. That is, before you came to Arabic numerals, if you wanted to say 8 in Hebrew, you said chet. Letters and numbers were identical. They were the same thing. All right? The idea that you represent numbers separately by numerals, Roman or Arabic, came later. That means that every word was, in fact, a numerical equivalent. It wasn't that somebody was just pretending that it was a numerical equivalent. Now, just imagine if A was 1 and B was 2 and C was 3, what you could do with English words, right? If they all had numbers as well as letters. That's what Hebrew gematria, numerology, does with Hebrew letters and words. So the simplest one, the one that everyone knows is chai, which is 18, 8 and 1, right? But it's very complex, very detailed, and particularly in mystical circles, mystics were always attracted to numbers. Pythagoras, going back to Pythagoras and the Greeks, who was a numbers mystic as well as a mathematician, and there is something very mystical about higher mathematics. I say this as somebody who understands nothing about higher mathematics, but if you read anybody who does higher mathematics, the reason numbers are mystical in part is that it's miraculous that they actually correspond to the world. I mean, think about that for a second, right? How is it that numbers that we invent, since after all we sort of invented them, also happen to measure accurately the way the world works? How can you take human numbers and predict the cycles of the planets? It's mystical and miraculous. How is it that the laws that we, simple laws of geometry, why is it that, the two sides of a triangle, the isosceles triangle, which, by the way, is gotten wrong in The Wizard of Oz, for those of you who... But why do those things work? And the answer is, according to classical, mystical, mathematical thinking, because that's a glimpse into the mind of God. The laws of nature are a glimpse. Einstein said this too, but in a much more modern way. The laws of nature are glimpses into the mind of God, and you figure out the laws of nature through mathematics. So mathematics has always had a very powerful mystical appeal, and numbers, changes in numbers, have a very powerful mystical appeal. So if you ever see a mystical amulet, it has a whole series of letters that are letters as well as numbers. And mystical amulets, although not as common today, were very, very, very common throughout most of Jewish history. Those of you who want to know more about this, the classic work, although there are more modern ones, but the classic work is by a rabbi named Trachtenberg, Joshua Trachtenberg, called Jewish Magic and Superstition. Notice that he puts those in two different, Jewish magic and superstition. And you can read all about many magical spells, superstitious ideas, and so on, that Jews have believed, and a lot of them are around numbers and numerology. I remember having a rabbi, when I was in rabbinical school, a rabbi came who's actually a very well-known rabbi, so I won't give his name, although I'm sure he'd be happy to repeat it today. And he was doing lots of this stuff, numerology, showing how the Torah was divine because of numbers, because a word going one way, if you reverse it, it means the opposite, and so on. And I raised my hand and I said, look, live and evil in English, they're the opposite of each other, right? E-V-I-L, L-I-V-E. The difference is that, first of all, when someone notices that in English, they just think it's coincidental. Nobody says, aha, there's a deep mystical meaning here. And also because English doesn't work by a root system, which Hebrew does, right? You have three or four root words, and then you add letters to them, which makes it much more likely that you're going to have these kinds of correspondences between different words. But he insisted that, in fact, in English it was a coincidence, but in Hebrew it was divinely planted in the Torah, and he's not alone. A lot of people believe that, as you know. So for what it's worth, name changes, things like that, will have many interpretations, many of them quite beautiful and ingenious. But we'll leave them alone for the moment. And it's not, by the way, impossible. In fact, it's likely. Whoever wrote the Torah, whether it was God or human beings or some combination of, whoever wrote the Torah knew that all the Hebrew letters also had numerical equivalents. That's what they were working with. So it's very likely that they wrote it with both consciousnesses in mind. Okay, there's a very long answer to a short question. All right, verse 15. 15. 17, 15. Since we just talked about Sarah's name change, let's... And God said to Abraham, now remember he's Abraham, and will be forevermore. He never changes back to Abram. As for your wife Sarai, you shall not call her Sarai, but her name shall be Sarah. And I always found that interesting. He doesn't say, as for your wife Sarai, her name will be Sarah. He says, as for your wife Sarai, you will not call her Sarai. So there's a nice way and a not so nice way of interpreting this. The not so nice way is Abraham's calling of her is determinative of her name. Right? Whatever Abraham calls her, that's what she's called. In fact, the Talmud says that everybody has three names, the one your parents call you, the one that the people around you call you, and the one you earn for yourself. This sounds like Abraham gets to decide, but it may also be God's defense of Sarah. That is, I know you've spent the last 30 years, 40 years, 50, actually, what, 60 years, I don't know what age they got married, 70 years since calling her Sarai, but I'm not naming her for everybody else, right? I'm naming her for everybody, including you. So from now on, you call her Sarah. That's possible that she remains the same, but to you she'll change. Although in the Bible, a name change is supposed to denote a change in the person, too. That's why people change their names when they get sick, right? To fool the Malach HaMavet, to fool the angel of death. Because you are supposed to undergo some kind of shift. God says to Abraham, walk before me and be blameless, and now you'll be Abraham. Jacob struggles and he becomes Israel. So maybe, but I think that Sarah is supposed to be different, too, to carry out the message of, remember, she's got to be different before she does what? What's she about to do? She's about to have Isaac. She's about to have her kid. I will bless her. Indeed, I will give you a son by her. Okay, now this is nice, actually. It says, Mimena, Lecha ben, v'gam natati mimena lecha ben, and also by her will I give you a son. What does that mean? What's the point of that verse?
Because Abraham thought the last time you didn't believe God, right, that it's going to be true.
Right. So first of all, he's saying, even though Abraham's about to disbelieve it again, I'm going to give you a son from her. And second, not Yishmael. From her I'm going to give you a son, right? Because as you'll see in a second again, Abraham still kind of hopes that maybe Ishmael will be the son. And God is saying it's got to be a son through Sarah, because remember, Sarah is the one who determines the future of the Jewish people, not Abraham, right? Because Abraham, after Sarah dies, Abraham has lots more kids. None of them carry the Miriam. Okay, that's a nice way of reading Vagam. Here, you could read it, I'll bless you and give you a son by her, or you could say, I'll bless you, and in addition to the son I gave you by Ishmael, I'm giving you a son by her. I will bless her so that she shall give rise to nations, rulers of people shall issue from her. Now, what's Abraham's reaction to this? Right. Sure, God. Tell me some more. Abraham threw himself on his face and laughed. Now, does he throw himself on his face so God doesn't see him laughing? Maybe. Right? It's not nice to laugh at God. Right? You remember that? Yes, exactly. It's not nice to fool Mother Nature. There was a commercial years ago for margarine. It's not nice to fool Mother Nature. So, I mean, it's not nice for Abraham to laugh at God's promise. He says to himself, can a child be born to a man 100 years old, or can Sarah bear a child at 90? So he disbelieves God's miracle both in relation to him and in relation to Sarah, but notice he calls her Sarah. Very, very fast adjusting guy, Abraham. And even though he's saying this to himself, you notice. So he has already internalized the change. She's no longer Sarai, she's Sarah, and he knows it inside of himself. And what he says to God is not, you can't do it, or you can't have me do it, because he knows that that is chutzpah, right? That's, it's impolite, it's arrogance. But instead he says, Lu Yishmael Yichye Lefanecha, if only Yishmael would live before you. Now, what does that phrase mean? Tell me what you think it means. I'll give you at least two possibilities, but one of them is the obvious one, which is, what does he want? What's that? You have to say the whole phrase, because what does God want? I mean, what does Abraham want? He wants God to accept Ishmael as Abraham's heir, right? That's the usual meaning, and I think the pshat, that is the plain meaning of the text. But many interpreters are very uncomfortable with the idea that Abraham would say to God, please change your mind about my son. Because that's really, I mean, first he laughs at God's miracle-making power, and then he says, why don't you take the other one after God has said, you're going to have this one? So a lot of Jewish interpretation, a lot of classical interpreters say what Abraham is really saying is different. It has to do with Ishmael and not with God. Like the phrase, some of them bring the phrase, which you may remember from the Torah service, Va'atem hadvekim baronai Eloheichem chayim kulchem hayom. You who cling to God are alive today. Chayim kulchem hayom. Okay? When Abraham says, I wish Ishmael would live before you, yichyeh before you, he's saying, I wish Ishmael would change. Not that you, God, would accept him, but that Ishmael would discover the source of life. I wish my son would live before you. In other words, that Ishmael would be a different sort of person and you could just take Ishmael. Because after all, he already knows Ishmael, and Ishmael's already born and he already loves Ishmael, and he's not so convinced that he's going to get another kid. So he's not asking God to take someone who is unworthy. He's praying that Ishmael would be worthy, so God would take him. Yeah. Yeah, we don't normally think of it that way, but I mean, Abraham's attachment to Ishmael was probably very deep. And not only was it probably very deep, but remember every time, I mean, this is, it's not to say that later characters don't doubt God, because they do. But Abraham doesn't know God very well yet. Really, if you're reading the story, Abraham hasn't seen God do a miracle like have a 100-year-old and a 90-year-old get together and have a kid. Right? That's a pretty formidable miracle in the world. And nothing that God has yet done, I mean, it's true that Abraham won a war, but that's not contrary to the laws of nature. It's true that Abraham has seen God take a sacrifice, but even that, in the ancient world, for a God to take a sacrifice was not considered impossible. But for a 90-year-old, you know, to give birth, that already is something worth laughing about. And whether Abraham's laugh, again, I don't want to presume to interpret Abraham's laugh. Some people think Abraham's laugh is joyous. Some think it's disbelieving. I interpreted it as disbelieving, but some commentators say that it's a laugh of joy. So it doesn't fit terribly well to say it's a laugh of joy, but I don't want to, you know. What's that? Is Ishmael is what, 13? Something like that? I mean, yeah, he's a teenager. No, well, yes, 87, yes. But Hagar wasn't 100, which is, you know, yeah, well, in retrospect, we think that, but Abraham doesn't know that so much, apparently. I'll leave it at that. That does make sense, but we don't know that for a fact. Although, the fact that he has Isaac now obviously gives credence to that. God said, "Nevertheless, Sarah your wife shall bear you a son, and you shall name him Isaac, Yitzchak." Now, God doesn't say because you laughed. Not yet. This is God's way of saying, you know, I know what you did. I know you laughed. And you're going to commemorate it by naming him Yitzchak. Which is, by the way, it's a particularly wonderful thing because there's not a lot of laughter in the Bible. You know, there really isn't. In fact, there might be, however, more laughter than we think. And by that I say, I remember reading an article a while ago by Arnie Band. Some of you may know Arnie Band. He was a professor of Hebrew literature at UCLA. And he wrote an article about the book of Jonah. And he said that he thought that Jonah was supposed to be a satire. And it was supposed to be funny. And he makes a good case. And others have made a similar case. They say, look, every prophet goes, they scream, they yell, they're eloquent, everything. Nobody changes. Jonah comes to a city, says 6 words, everybody repents. Right? The idea that every time that you know, the storm calms whenever they're about to throw Jonah in. In fact, there is a midrash, Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, where they take Jonah, they dip him in, the storm calms, they pull him out, it starts storming again. They dip him in, it calms. I mean, the whole motif of his being swallowed by a whale, it all, you could see it being played for laughs if you wanted to. The problem is we don't, I mean, it's very hard for somebody to come to the Bible and assume they're going to, you know, they're going to laugh. Yeah.
Is there a coincidence of Ishmael's name and Isaac's name going back to the numerology that you referred to earlier?
In which way? Well, Yishma and Yitzchak, well, they both begin with a Yud, but that's it. Yishma means hear God, and Yitzchak means laughter. Although laughter, by the way, is not always a positive thing. The root Litzachek and Yitzchak is not always a positive thing in the Bible. Among other things, you know, that's when David and Saul's soldiers are killing each other, it's called Litzachek. They're playing this game with knives where they're killing each other. So it's true that Yitzchak might not just be a positive. But no, I don't see a Yitzchak and Yishmael, I don't see a connection, but who knows? Yeah.
Is face is used in the actual shot here, and how the thing about Ishmael, I wish it would be in your face, is actually what it's saying, would be live in your face.
Right.
And falling on those. I think that it really makes sense in what you were talking about in terms of relationship to God and how to face God because of the just the simple words. Right.
The comment was that it says really Ishmael should, and I'm cutting off just because there's when you speak in front and you speak softly, nobody in back can hear anything that you're saying. Everybody should just be aware of that. You were saying that it says not, I mean, the translation is God should live by your favor, but the Hebrew is lifanecha, which means before you or in your panim, in your face. And Abraham falls down on his face, and there is this facial motif, if you will. The idea that what you have, that your relationship to God is a face. Remember, Moshe said to see God face to face. Did you want to add anything to that? Okay. All right. And I will maintain my covenant with him as an everlasting covenant for his offspring to come. In other words, not with Ishmael, despite your plea, but only with Yitzchak. Yitzchak is going to be the one. And then it says, as for Ishmael, I've heeded you. I hereby bless him. I'll make him fertile and exceedingly numerous. He'll be the father of 12 chieftains, and I will make him a great nation. It's not that Abraham's prayer won't matter, but it won't get Ishmael to get the main blessing. Ishmael is going to get a subordinate blessing. My covenant I will maintain with Isaac, whom Sarah shall bear to you at this season next year. And when he was done speaking with him, God was gone from Abraham. Vayal Elohim me'al Avraham, which means sort of God lifted himself from on top of Abraham. That is, and you can imagine the imagery, the presence of God descends on you, and then the presence of God lifts from you. And Abraham is no longer in God's presence. Which is, of course, also later on a theological problem, because if God's everywhere, how are you in God's presence or not in God's presence? And there are all sorts of unsatisfactory answers to that. But I would say that it is true to our experience, even if it's not true to our intellectual understanding. Why is it that people feel different in a synagogue than they feel at a baseball game? Why is it that certain kinds of architecture or activities make you feel the presence of God and others don't? Why does someone say, at a sunset, I feel the presence of God, but, you know, I don't know, watching, I don't know, what is a debased show? Pick a show. I don't feel, you can pick any show. I don't feel the presence of God. Even though God should be equally present in all those places, in fact, the human experience is not of God's equal presence. There's that beautiful story I've told many times of the seer of Lublin who, when he was a child, used to go into the forest. And his father pulled him aside one day and said to him, you know, I see that you go, the seer of Lublin, by the way, was an 18th century Hasidic master. That's what he grew up to be. But he was a child, and his father said to him, I see that you go into the forest every day, and, you know, I don't want to tell you where you can go and where you can't go, but the forest is a dangerous place, and it's not for little boys to go alone, and I'm wondering what you're doing in there. And he said, well, I go there to find God. And his father said, that's very beautiful, but don't you know that God is the same everywhere? And he said, God is, but I'm not. So the same thing is true here. I mean, is the change in God or in Abraham? Impossible to say. Maybe Abraham took as much as he could take, and maybe that's the difference between Abraham and Moses. Moses could take continually being in God's presence, but no one else could. Yeah.
I don't know about the Hebrew, but the English seems like it's more than being in his presence. It seems like the penetration.
It says me'al, which means on. So. Right. When you're on something, you lift off of it. It's that kind of lifting. It's like right now I'm lifting the book off the. It doesn't say anything about being inside. It just says about being on. At least in this, you know, for what that's worth. It's not like the imagery in Jeremiah, which is very different. which has that imagery of penetration, but I don't think in the Hebrew that the Hebrew supports it here. Okay. Yitzchak. The Hebrew Yitzchak is a verbal form meaning he laughs. I'm reading from Sarna now. I'm not reading from the Bible. It's almost certainly an abbreviation of the original fuller form Yitzchak El. El laughs. God laughs, in other words. After the pattern of Yishmael, it should be Yitzchak El. Yishmael. God listens. God laughs. That's how kids are named, right? The full form is never found in the Bible, but all biblical traditions relating to Isaac connect the name with human laughter. The explanation is twofold. On the one hand, there's a deliberate dissociation from the pagan mythological meanings of Yitzchak El. You don't want to make God too human to say that God laughs, right? And on the other hand, the laughter of God in the Bible invariably expresses his reaction to the ludicrous attempts of men to act independently of his will. So let me just give you an example or two of that from Psalms. When does God laugh in the Bible? You know the old Yiddish phrase about human beings plan and God laughs. So that's very reflective of the biblical laughter of God. Here is, it's 2:4. He who is enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord mocks them, then speaks to them in anger and in rage. Okay? This is right after, when does God mock? Right after the nations assemble and the peoples plot vain things. That's one example. I'll give you one more. 37:13. These are from Psalms. The wicked man schemes against the righteous. The Lord laughs at him, for God knows that his day will come. Okay? When does God laugh? God laughs when human beings are arrogant. So, it doesn't, here though, it's Abraham who's laughing, but maybe God's laughing because Abraham thinks he can't do it. Right? It's not clear. Nonetheless, it's nice to have the motif of laughter introduced one way or another into the story. And Yitzchak, of course, bears that name throughout his life. Okay, yeah.
Does Islam acknowledge the existence of Isaac?
Yes. Islam does acknowledge the existence of Isaac, but what exactly it makes of him, that I'm not sure. It's a very interesting thing. Growing up in America, in an entirely Ashkenazi community, I can't remember ever studying this up to the last couple years where anybody asked, how does Islam feel about this? Because until 9/11 in America, and until I came in contact with the Iranian community here, the Ashkenazi community was so overwhelming, and Islam was so little a presence in America, and Christianity obviously so daunting, that I can answer lots of questions about how Christians read the Hebrew Bible, but I know very little about how Muslims read the Hebrew Bible, because it was never something that anybody particularly cared. Also because Muslims don't read the Hebrew Bible. And this is what we were studying. That's why I remember Maimonides thought Christians were pagans and Muslims were monotheists. But he would not allow Jews to study the Bible with Muslims and would allow them to study the Bible with Christians. Because even though Christians were pagans, they accepted the Bible. They didn't say this is wrong. God really brought Ishmael up to the mountain instead of Isaac. They interpreted the Bible incorrectly, as far as Maimonides was concerned, but at least they accept that what happened here happened. Muslims, whom he knew were monotheists, I mean, Muslims are very strict monotheists, and Maimonides lived among them, and he understood them, and learned from them, and read Muslim books, and had, you know, was the doctor to the Sultan of Cairo, so he had a powerful Muslim contact. But he didn't want any Jews to study the Bible because they would always say, no, 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 this is wrong. This isn't what happened. You have to read the Quran. So, but anyway, so I don't know how Islamic tradition treats Isaac, but it would be a very interesting thing to discover. There is a Jewish scholar in the city, actually Reuven Firestone, whom some of you may know, who has an expertise in Muslim and Jewish exegesis understanding of the Hebrew Bible, and maybe sometime I'll have him come and do a class. I think that, I'll call him and ask him if he'll come and do a Thursday morning class. That would be great. And he can answer all your questions about it. Yes?
Is there anything about Jews studying the Quran? Is there any prohibition of that?
Well, the prohibition against Jews studying the Quran is identical to the prohibition of Jews studying any sacred text. That is, there is a big debate in, two things. There's a big debate in Jewish tradition whether you're allowed to study something outside the Torah anyway. Right? Some rabbis say yes, some rabbis say no. There's a comment in the Talmud where it says you should study Torah day and night. So it says you are permitted to study Greek wisdom just when it's not day and it's not night, because that's when you're supposed to be studying Torah. I mentioned Maimonides before. Maimonides, for example, was one who said that studying things like mathematics, language, and so on will enhance your understanding of Torah, but others disagree, who said everything is contained in Torah and any study of something outside of Torah is illegitimate. Certainly to study the sacred texts of other people couldn't possibly enhance your Jewish knowledge, learning, understanding, growing closer to God. For most of Jewish history, that was pshita. It was sort of understood. I don't think Jews realized, and this was less true with, there were Jews who understood and read Arabic poetry and understood the traditions of the Quran, but to study the Quran, not unless you were very edgy, let's put it that way. And you have to realize how deep this animosity goes. And again, I have to revert to Hebrew Christian. Jewish Christian, I can't speak as much to Jewish Muslim. I will tell you a little known fact, and you'll see why we don't advertise it. There are 2 days of the year on which in Eastern European communities, and I'm referring only to Eastern European communities, you didn't study Torah. You were not allowed to study Torah. Okay. Anybody want to guess what the 2 days were? Christmas and Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av, because you were supposed to be sad, and studying Torah brings you joy. So you were allowed to study Job and Lamentations if you wanted to study anything, because those are sad parts of the Torah. But the rest you can't study, because everybody knows that studying Torah is the greatest joy, and on Tisha B'Av you're supposed to be in mourning. That's the destruction of the temple. The other time is Christmas. Why can't you study on Christmas? Yes? Would go to? In a way, you're right. In a way, you're exactly right. Because when you study on the Yahrzeit, on the anniversary of someone's death, you are helping their soul move along in celestial spheres to wherever it's going. You don't want to give Jesus a leg up, so you don't study on Christmas. Now, we all think this is funny, but think, just reflect on the depth of animosity and distance and anger that speaks to. Okay?
Wouldn't it have been more appropriate on Easter?
It's not appropriate at all.
Right. So, okay, yeah.
So then, Christmas sometimes does fall on Shabbos. So,
you, I would override, you would still read Torah. Yeah. This is a folk tradition. It's not, I'm not aware of it being enshrined in a law. But you get the idea. Right. Yeah. Easter, right, that's what he said. Maybe it was Easter. Yeah. Don't want him to resurrect again. Yeah. Is it, I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. Is it what? Right. I didn't say that he refers to God. I said that the name mythologically, what Sarna is saying is its roots are Yitzchak El, right? That God laughs. And when you use that name, it's not referring to the incident. It's not referring to Abraham's having laughed here. It's referring to the meaning of God's laughter, even though it's not, the full name isn't given. So it's referring to God's laughter, but not here. Rather permanently, just like when you call someone Yishmael, it doesn't mean God listened this second necessarily, it means God listens and gave me this child. So, okay. Then Abraham, let's see if we can at least read the rest of the chapter. Then Abraham took his son Ishmael and all his homeborn slaves. We're on verse 23. And all those he had bought, every male in Abraham's household, and he circumcised the flesh of their foreskins on that very day, as God had spoken to him. Abraham was 99 years old when he circumcised the flesh of his foreskin, and his son Ishmael was 13 years old when he circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin. Thus Abraham and his son Ishmael were circumcised on that very day, and all his household, his homeborn slaves, and those that had been bought from outsiders were circumcised with him. Okay, so Abraham changes, Ishmael changes, the whole household is different, and they're all ready now for the arrival of Isaac, which is why circumcision in Islam is done when?
13.
At 13. Because Ishmael is circumcised at 13. Yes. What's that? How did we get to 8 days? Because that's when he's going about to command him to circumcise Isaac. And we talked last time about why, about circumcision and about why it's 8 days. But you can see why the Islamic tradition promote circumcision at 13 days as opposed to 8 days. And I don't, for those of you who are interested, last week's class we talked a lot about circumcision. If you want to know about circumcision, its background, its history, so on, you can refer to that or to the books that I mentioned in last week's class. Okay, so now the stage is set for the beginning of the Jewish people as opposed to the beginning of a Jewish person or a Jewish couple. Because you don't get a people until you get offspring. And remember, up to now, Abraham went through a sequence of events. First he says, is Eliezer, my servant, going to inherit from me? And God says, no, you're going to have a child. Then he has a child, but it's not from Sarah. And God says, yes, you actually should listen to Sarah and kick the kid out of the house. So he does that, and then God tells him again, you're going to have a child, and he says, can it be Ishmael? And God says, no, it has to be Yitzchak. The theme of the difficulty of having children is a very powerful theme in the Bible, and you can understand why, because Jews are a small people. It's not as though, I mean, we don't have a founder that had lots and lots and lots and lots of children who in turn had lots and lots and lots of children, right? It took until Jacob, and Jacob's family, even though there were 12 of them, was continually on the brink of destruction, right? First, you know, from the famine, from the divide between them, and then in Egypt, in slavery, who knew that they were ever going to emerge a distinctive people? So there's a lot of, there's a lot of the theme of how hard it is to produce a people. You see it again, of course, with Rachel. You see it with Ruth. It runs all through the Bible, even beyond the Torah. Okay, any questions about any of the stuff we did today? Yeah. Why did it take so long for Muslims to declare their religion? Because Muhammad wasn't born until the 7th century.
But it doesn't make sense that, you know, thousands of years
Well, ago, I don't want to start giving you Muslim apologetics. I mean, you have to, that's properly addressed to a Muslim. My guess is that the answer you would get, which is seems to be, from what I understand, is the Muslim line, is that the revelation that God had given was so badly misunderstood that he had to give a new revelation to Muhammad to people who would keep it clear the way it was supposed to be. Because the Muslim read of the Hebrew Bible is that a lot of it is true, but a lot of it is mixed up. So that's what I assume it is. But remember, every religion that comes later has to explain why it is that it has to come later. And the answer is usually the former ones didn't get it quite right. So that's what Christianity says about Judaism. That's what Islam says about Christianity. That's what Mormonism says about Islam and Christianity and Judaism altogether. Every new revelation is because the previous revelation either was not adequate or was not completely correct or was messed up by the people who got it. So that's not in religious history, it happens again and again. Yeah. I'm reading you what the Bible says. I don't know what he said. Right, but I don't know where he's talking about. I don't see anybody giving birth to six people at a time. The only place where I understood that he might say that is there is a Midrashic tradition about the Jews in Egypt who gave birth to many at a time. And that's why the Egyptians were so frightened, because there were multiple births and so on. But remember to distinguish. Let me put it this way. I want to... Jewish tradition, traditionally, does not distinguish between the Bible and rabbinic traditions about the Bible. That is, I can stand before you and say, remember, as the Bible tells us, Abraham broke the idols in his father's store. Then you'll go home and innocently read the story of Abraham, and there are no idols, and there's no store, and there's no breakage. You'll come back and you'll say to me, well, I thought you said the Bible said that. And I'll say, well, it says right in the Talmud that Abraham did that. And you'll say, but that's the Talmud. And my answer will be that all these, to the oral tradition and the written tradition, get not, I don't want to say mixed up, they get combined in the Jewish mind. So when the rabbi says that, the answer is no, the Bible does not say that. The rabbis say that that's what happened, and Torah is more expansive than this book. The question is, what degree of credence do you want to give to rabbinic traditions? And while we're on the subject of Islam and rabbinic traditions, many things in the Quran have parallels in the Midrash. So from a Jewish scholarly point of view, these things were assumed by everyone to be true. Muhammad incorporates them in the biblical story because he's heard them too, because we know that Muhammad had contact with Jewish communities. He assumes them to be true. He incorporates them in the Quran, but in fact, they're Midrashic stories. They're rabbinic stories, right? Now, as far as the Islamic tradition is concerned, the Quranic traditions go all the way back. So in fact, the Jews may have had some of them, but what Muhammad was giving you was the straight old story. And any Midrashic traditions that were around, it's just because that was what happened, but it didn't get recorded in here, which is just more evidence that this isn't the whole story. So the last thing I'll say about this is, remember, this isn't the whole story. We don't know what other stories were circulating at the time that the Bible was written. The Bible itself makes reference to books that we don't have. It says you can read about this in the books of the kings of whatever. And we don't have that book. So we don't know what else was circulating at the time. Yeah.
Relationships to many people. The covenant is with Jewish men.
Right.
And not Jewish women. Even though it's a relationship, but it's with Jewish men. But he has relationship to Hagar. And
yes.
He has relationships outside. And so I think that through the development of what you were talking about, the oral tradition, a lot of the people, like Esau, the way I read Esau in the Torah that's written, he's a much more understandable, lovable person who forgives, who is much than the tradition portrays him over the years.
Well, remember,
I really think that what's the covenant and what's God's relationship to others is really an important issue for our time. It's maybe not the same issue as when the Jews were living in this devil in Europe. I mean, my cousin was born on Christmas would feel very bad if that's the day that they don't study Torah.
That's why I ask people to keep their comments short, because other people can't hear them and they're leaving people, you know, in silence for a long time. The question is about the covenant of God with other people. Yishmael is a much more, as Esau is, a much more sympathetic character in the Bible than he is made in later Jewish tradition. And that's true, for obvious reasons, because you don't relate to a character by who they are originally, you relate to a character by what they bring into your life. And I assure you that the Jews around Jesus felt more sympathetically towards Jesus than the Jews in 1500 who had to deal with Jesus's religious descendants. And part of the problem for both Islam and Christianity is that each of them, both religions, were born every religion is born in some kind of revolution. When that revolution, which in the course especially of Judaism and Christianity was a family fight, when a family fight gets enshrined in a sacred text, it freezes forever a bad moment in the relationship of two groups. And that becomes a paradigm forever and ever and ever and ever. So the Jews didn't just reject Jesus once at that moment. They rejected him forever and ever and ever and ever. And the idea that Jesus is in fact Jewish is a very peripheral idea in most Christian teaching and learning, because there's this decisive break that gets recorded at the moment, and you all know what families say to each other when they fight. And it's not friendly. And you wouldn't want that to be the freeze frame of your family for the rest of history. But that's what happens. In terms of God's relationship to other people, this is a subject that in fact has had tremendous commentary in Judaism and in Christianity and in Islam forever and ever. And in fact, in the after Nostra Aetate particularly, but in the last 50 years, many Christian theologians have developed what's called dual covenant theology. That is, that the covenant with Christianity, which is, remember, that's the New Testament, means new covenant. Brit Chadasha is what it's called in Hebrew, the new Brit, the new covenant. That the new covenant does not supplant but supplements the old. That God's covenant with the Jewish people remains despite the fact that there is, and this has now become more or less the official theology of the Catholic Church, that God's covenant with the Jewish people was never broken, will never be broken, but that Jesus came to usher in a new understanding, depth, breadth, so on, of the covenant. This is the problem with being a monotheist. Pagans had it easier this way. Paganism was in some ways inherently more tolerant. You have your God, I have my God, he has his God, you say potato, I say potato, right? I'm trivializing it a little bit, but you get the basic idea. However, that's not true for a monotheist. For a monotheist, if in fact God reveals God's self a certain way, and you think, you know, that God is a statue, you're wrong. You're just wrong. And then the question is what God wants me to do to correct your mistake. And we all know that monotheism therefore has a capacity for intolerance, but so does every passionate belief. It's a problem. Humanity does advance by people who think they're right and other people are wrong. But humanity also regresses by people who think they're right and other people are wrong. So to find a tolerant monotheism is, I would say, it used to be an urgent religious question. Now it's probably the most urgent human question that there is in the world right now. And if you want to do it, here's a good place to start. From Amos chapter 9, verse 7, you don't have to turn to it, but if you want to, you can. To me, Israelites, this is Amos talking, right? This isn't a second-rate prophet. To me, Israelites, you're just like the Ethiopians, declares God. True, I brought Israel up from the land of Egypt, but also the Philistines from Kaphtor and the Arameans from Kir. In other words, you think you're the only ones I brought up. I brought other people up too. You're just like the Ethiopians to me. It's not that I don't have relationships with everybody else. It's just that, you know, your appointment is at 10:30 in the morning. You don't see the relationship the doctor has with the patient that comes at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So everybody cherishes the idea that they have the special relationship. And you don't like to see those other patients, you know, because what are they doing in your doctor's office? And just think about how much more comprehensive that is with God. Everybody wants to believe that they have the comprehensive. And in my experience of the question of tolerance, tolerance is much easier when you don't care about it. You know, I say this all the time, but it's true. People who are religiously tolerant, ask them about the subject of abortion and the other side are, you know, evil. Because that they really care about. Right? Ask them about politics and either Democrats or they're either morally muddled on the Democratic side or they're Neanderthals on the Republican side, because that they really care about. But why can't religions tolerate one another? If you're really tolerant, you have to pick the thing that you really care about most and then decide how in your mind you see the people who are on the other side of that question. That's what tolerance is about. Because the people you're asking to be tolerant believe with all their heart and soul that God said this. They're absolutely convinced of it. And if tolerance means convincing them that God didn't really say this, then tolerance is doomed. Somehow you have to have tolerance even though you're absolutely convinced you're right. That's when tolerance matters, and that's a hard one. That is a hard one. And the best place to start is with things you're absolutely convinced you're right about, and then try to figure out how tolerant you are. Because it just means that God demands, this is right, God demands this of us. It's also right that God demands other things of other people, which is true. God demands less of non-Jews in the Jewish tradition than God demands of Jews. But there's only one God and he gave this Bible. So, and what they think is sacred, according to classical Jewish belief, is not. It's not. You know, when, look there, I mean, you can say, and on this we'll close. You can say Jews come, Christians come to God through Jesus. And then a Jew will come to you and say, well, does that mean that you believe Jesus was other than just a guy? And then you have a problem. Because if you say no, you say, well, then well, how can Christians in fact come to God through Jesus? So it's a very, you know, tolerance is a tricky question. The only Jewish thinker, classical Jewish thinker that I know of who sort of began dual covenant theology was Franz Rosenzweig, who wrote almost nothing about Islam. He was in Germany in the early 1900s, but he said that Judaism was the sun and Christianity was the rays of the sun. That is, Judaism was the source of monotheism and Christianity spread it to the world. But he came out of a heavily Christian background as a Jew. I mean, his cousin converted to Christianity. He considered converting to Christianity. Working out a theology that, in fact, promotes how different traditions can come to God is for next week.